From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. How much time did you spend in the great outdoors this weekend? Well, if you're like most Americans, not much. A 2008 study showed that the average American spends about 25% less time in nature than in 1987. And it's not much better for our children. A group called the Outdoor Foundation released a survey last year that shows childhood has moved indoors, with less than 60% of America's youth participating in outdoor activities. The trend has caught the attention of Dr. Scott Sampson, research curator at the Utah Museum of Natural History, and this hour he joins me to talk about the consequences of losing a love of place. Plus, a report on the dying forests of the Intermountain West. It's the environment this hour, and your calls coming up after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Dr. Scott Sampson is best known for his expansive work on dinosaurs, those massive creatures that roamed the Earth millions of years ago. But as engaged as he is with dinosaur lives and extinction, he's also enthralled with our own standing in the world and our continuing evolution as a species. What happens, he asks, when humans lose a love of and a connection to their local environment? And in this digital age, can we reconnect with the natural world? Today on the program, reviving topophilia, or a love of place. Dr. Scott Sampson will deliver the 61st annual Frederick W. Reynolds Lecture at the University of Utah tomorrow night at Rice-Eccles Stadium. More information is on our website, kcpw.org. Joining me in this hour is Dr. Scott Sampson. He's a paleontologist and evolutionary biologist and research curator at the Utah Museum of Natural History. He was the primary scientific consultant and on-air host of the four-part Discovery Channel series, Dinosaur Planet, and he's also well-known as Dr. Scott the Paleontologist on the hit PBS children's program Dinosaur Train. He's also written numerous scholarly articles and is author of the book Dinosaur Odyssey, Fossil Threads in the Web of Life, and Scott Sampson joins me from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. Dr. Sampson, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Jennifer. Nice to be speaking with you again.
And again, Dr. Sampson will deliver a lecture tomorrow night at Rice-Eccles Stadium. More information is on our website, kcpw.org. Later in the program, we're going to be talking about how and why forests throughout the West are dying. But first, a conversation on a love of place. What strategies do you have for getting yourself and your kids outside? Join the conversation with your questions or comments, 801-355-TALK. Talk is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Scott Sampson, as I mentioned, you know, you're best known to millions of kids and adults as Dr. Scott the Paleontologist on Dinosaur Train. Why are you turning your attention from the very distant past to our troubles now in the present?
Well, I just reached the point in my life where I thought I can't keep focusing on animals that have been extinct for millions of years. We're in the middle of a major crisis, a crisis in sustainability, a crisis in childhood. And I thought if I can make a dent in that and have some kind of impact, then that's what I'm going to do. And it just turns out that kids have this amazing love for dinosaurs, and you can turn that into a fascination with science in general, and perhaps even a fascination with nature today.
The declining interest in outdoor recreation among all Americans, but particularly among young adults and youth, has been a growing concern for a number of years now. What really brought this home to you, and what compelled you to start speaking out about it?
I think I came to the conclusion that the crisis that we face in sustainability is much less a crisis of technology, that is, of the external world, and much more a crisis of consciousness or mind, our internal world, and therefore education. I mean, our kids today spend 7 to 10 hours staring at screens every single day and less than a half hour outside. And that is 90% less time outdoors than we had when I grew up a generation ago. Now, that's very bad for the health of our children, but it's also bad for the health of the places that we live. If we have no experience of the places that we live, how are we ever going to care about them? And if we don't care about them, why would we think about making them sustainable?
Mm. Your talk tomorrow night is titled The Extinction of Experience, Youth, Nature, and Sustainability in the Digital Age. Do you really think that our experience of nature is headed toward extinction?
Yeah, that term came from an author named Robert Michael Pyle, who said, you know, how can we possibly head into the future sustainably? Why would a child ever care about a condor, for example, if they've never seen a wren? And if we can't get past this, if most of our experience of the world is virtual and we've given up the real reality, then why would we care about these places? So I think that it was that realization that just made me think we have to work on this as hard as we possibly can. It's one of the most pressing challenges that we face in this century.
You're putting forth what you're calling the topophilia hypothesis. First, what's topophilia, and what is this hypothesis that you're suggesting?
Yes, topophilia sounds a little bit like a disease, and that's unfortunate. But it does mean a love of place. For about 20 years, the notion of biophilia, a love of life, has been out there. It was an idea suggested by E.O. Wilson, but it's never really got much traction with scientists, in part because it's been largely untestable. So what I've put forth in a volume that's coming out in the spring is the notion of the topophilia hypothesis, that in fact we have a genetic propensity to form bonds with local nature, because for most of the tenure that we've been a species, Homo sapiens, we spent that time as hunter-gatherers living in intimate connection with the non-human world. And it's often thought that humans became human by separating themselves from nature. But what I'm arguing is that that didn't really happen until about 12,000 years ago. And for the previous tens of thousands of years before that, we managed to survive and spread all over the globe, not by separating ourselves from nature, but by becoming intimately related to it in every generation, learning about all the plants and animals, all the carnivores, the things that are threats to us. And humans are an amazing species. We can be born anywhere and live anywhere on the planet, but in every generation, particularly as hunter-gatherers, we had to learn how to live in place. And what I'm arguing is that we may have a genetic propensity to form these emotional bonds with nature, and that this may be akin to the mother-infant bond. And if we don't have such a bond, then we end up being very unhealthy adults, in the same way that infants denied that attachment to their mothers also grew up unhealthy.
We're speaking with Dr. Scott Sampson, paleontologist, evolutionary biologist, and research curator for the Utah Museum of Natural History. He'll be delivering a lecture tomorrow night. More information on that as we go. If you have questions about the topophilia hypothesis, give us a call, 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. You mentioned the renowned evolutionary biologist E.O. Wilson, and I believe that he wrote about how we as humans we're predisposed to want to be in nature, in natural habitats, that physically our eyes relax when we look at a landscape of savanna or, you know, some sort of pastoral setting. Is this what you mean by topophilia, having this innate love of the land? It's part of our genetic makeup?
Yes, except that I would change it, modify it slightly, and say that it's not just a generic love of the land and of life, but of the places that we happen to be growing up. E.O. Wilson actually focused on the living world as opposed to the non-human world, even though he talked about savanna environments. And don't get me wrong, E.O. Wilson is a brilliant man who's made amazing contributions, both socially and scientifically. But the tweak that I'm proposing is that if we don't learn about the places that we're living in, if we don't have those emotional bonds with the places that we grow up, we may be missing something very key to our youth and to our growth. And we might therefore grow up having issues with, for example, attention deficit disorder, which we're seeing all over the place now in childhood. So these are the kinds of things that I'm really trying to focus attention on. Having said that, because you have a genetic propensity, it doesn't mean that you're going to develop that bond in the same way that if you don't have the mother there, you're not going to develop that infant maternal bond. So we need to expose our children to the non-human world, to nature. And right now that's just not happening very much. And so there needs to be a clarion call to get kids outside.
So if bonding with our immediate surroundings is part of who we are as humans, part of this genetic makeup, how come we aren't being drawn to nature right now? Why does the draw of technology and the digital environment have such influence, such power over us?
Well, when I was a kid, and when most people my age were kids, our parents basically opened up the front door at the end of the day or the beginning of the day and kicked us outside and said, come back in when it's dark. And that doesn't happen anymore. And so when we grew up, we had a chance to form these bonds with the non-human world. But right now, kids are inside. The parents are concerned about them being outside for all kinds of reasons, security, etc. And therefore, they're spending all this time in front of screens, so they're not forming these bonds. They don't feel any kind of attachment to the non-human world. And that is where that's the core of this crisis now. But it's not just that. We need to think about how we educate kids, what we teach them about the non-human world. Do they know how the places that they live work? And one of the proposals that I'm putting forth in all of this, too, and it's by no means novel. It goes back 100 years, but we should be focusing education around the places that we live as well, all the way from kindergarten through university, that we should be, all of our education should be focused around where we live, not just in science, but in English, social studies, and history. We need to learn about our own local oak forest before we learn about the Amazon rainforest. And we need to have that direct, firsthand experience in those places. And if we do that, kids are going to grow up caring about these places, more engaged with them. They'll become a citizenry that has a chance of achieving sustainability.
What I think I hear you saying is that, you know, part of the blame, if that's the right word, must be on the adults who are afraid to get dirty. Because when you're a kid, you go out and dig in the dirt and it's no big deal. But parents are reluctant to send their kids out with all the bugs and the lack of modern conveniences and let them explore. Is that part of it? How we as adults, the grown-ups, have to learn to let go?
I would, in some ways, that's the majority of it. I'm not saying that we need to put the responsibility of fixing our problems on the next generation. I'm saying that we as adults need to see that what we're doing doesn't work. We need to bring up our children differently so that they can stand on our shoulders and see far further than we can even imagine right now. And yes, part of it is this paranoia about the outdoors and how it hurts us, even though there's hundreds and hundreds of studies now that demonstrate that having that attachment to the outdoors reduces stress. It helps to get over any kinds of health problems. Even people who have a window in their hospital room get over surgery. They recover faster than if they don't have a window. I mean, it's just built into who we are, and we're denying our children this really important aspect of their being right now.
Dr. Scott Sampson, he's a paleontologist and evolutionary biologist and the research curator for the Utah Museum of Natural History. He will be delivering the 61st annual Frederick W. Reynolds Lecture at the University of Utah tomorrow night at 6:30. That is happening in the Varsity Room at Rice-Eccles Stadium. The lecture is free and open to the public. Those who are 8 and older are invited. For more information, you can call 801-585-0911. Or you can visit the City Views page on our website, kcpw.org. We're going to continue our conversation with Dr. Scott Sampson after a quick break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Paleontologist and evolutionary biologist Scott Sampson is asking the question, how can we reconnect with our environment and what happens to our species if we don't? Dr. Sampson is delivering the Reynolds Lecture at the University of Utah tomorrow night. We'll have more on that as we go. Right now, we invite you to join the conversation. How do we rekindle a love of place? 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can email us at cityviews@kcpw.org. Dr. Sampson, how do we nurture this love of place? How do we engender a passion for the great outdoors among adults who may not have that own passion themselves?
Yeah, I think that's a challenge, and I think it begins with just recognizing that there is an issue and that we need to get kids outside, and it has to start young. The younger, the better. Getting kids outside, you don't need to be an expert on nature, local plants and animals to just get your kids outside. You can discover it with them, whether you're doing it in the backyard or the local park or hiking up into the Wasatch Front, whatever it might be, that's the place to start. And give them some unstructured time to play. Too often now our kids' lives are completely structured down to the minute, and they have no time just to be creative on their own. And the great thing about the outdoors, as opposed to an indoor classroom or even a regular playground, is that there's thousands of loose parts. So it gives them the chance to be creative and to think up things on their own and get inspired. And that's how we start to form these emotional, affective kinds of bonds.
You mentioned time on the playground and in the classroom. I'm wondering what role you see schools having in reintroducing, you know, the glories of nature to our young people. What role and what responsibility do teachers have in your hypothesis?
I think the teachers have a huge responsibility here, but it's also up to the universities to train the teachers to give them the tools to, for example, teach to place, have a topophilic kind of curriculum where we bring up kids that know about where their food comes from, where their water comes from, where their wastes go to, where the energy comes from, where they get kids outside and engaged in these places. And older kids can start to engage in service or community learning kinds of projects where they're maybe reclaiming a stream or growing a garden, things that really help them understand where they come from. Another key element is the story of place. We live in this little snapshot of time called the present, and we don't really think too much these days about where we come from or where we're going. And let's be realistic, why would anyone care about the future unless they have a sense of their past? And so what is our story? And part of it is the science story that's come together the last 20 years that tells us the story from the Big Bang to the present day. We're arguably the first culture in human history for which a large proportion of the people don't really have a cosmological story, don't have a sense of meaning that runs deep in terms of where they come from. And so it's difficult for them to even envision how to grasp getting involved in the future.
Finding resources for teachers and for parents, I mean, sometimes it boils down to money. And are there ways to work around those budgetary restraints? Because we're all living in this world where money is it's limited.
Well, the great thing about nature is that it's free for the most part, and you can go outside and you can, for example, take a regular school ground, bring plant native plants. That means native insects will come back. That means you'll get more birds, put out bird feeders. You can put nature into the school grounds quite easily, so it doesn't cost a lot of money. But we also need to train our teachers differently. Most teachers that are teaching science right now in elementary and high school don't have science degrees. And we need to make sure that our teachers are trained properly so that they can make these kinds of connections, and give kids this big picture that they can sort of anchor their perspective on the world on.
Are you seeing this happening where you are in the Bay Area right now or along the Wasatch Front here in Utah? Are you seeing teachers sort of getting this, you know, restoring nature and the consciousness of place? Is it on the radar?
Yeah, one of the things that gives me a lot of hope right now is that there's a movement that's spreading across the country. Part of it was triggered by a book called Last Child in the Woods by Richard Louv, which sort of rang the alarm bell about the lack of nature exposure that our kids are getting. And that triggered movements. There's like 80 organizations that have sprung up as a result of that book, as well as legislation being passed in many states, No Child Left Inside types of legislation. And teachers are getting involved too. Teachers are becoming more place-based, more eco-friendly, sort of more environmental education. So I think it's out there now, and the models are great. There's a lot of studies now that are backing up the notion that an environmentally based education not only engages us more with where we live, but it actually increases academic performance across the board. So if we're worried about keeping up with the Joneses, so to speak, in other countries with regard to our education, one of the best ways to do that is through outdoor-related, environmental, place-based education.
We are, though. I mean, the reality is, as you mentioned, kids are spending a lot of time in front of a screen. We live in this mediated world, and it doesn't seem like it's going away. Is there a way to tap into the technology as a tool to bring us back to nature? Is that possible?
Absolutely. I think it is. And I think at a number of levels, we can tap into all the technologies that we have. Digital technologies, for example, even in our handhelds, you can download apps today that will tell you what the constellations are in the night sky. You can download another app to take a picture of a leaf and then upload it and find out what plant you're looking at, or record the sound of a bird and figure out what species it is. So there's a number of applications like that that are great. Social media, kids can interact now in all kinds of different ways with Facebook and Twitter and all these other platforms. Imagine if we were getting kids learning about their local places, uploading information about those places so that every place around the country was creating this open learning, free access information that teachers anywhere could tap into. There's these amazing citizen science programs that are out now, largely started at the Cornell ornithology labs, where, for example, you can go observe birds in your backyard, upload the data onto a website, and scientists are using that data to, for example, map the arrival and departure of birds that are migrating, which, of course, helps us understand the impact of global warming. So it's easy to get kids related with social media. Mass media has to have a huge role, too. We need to use it to help get kids motivated, and that's what I try and do with the PBS show Dinosaur Train. At the end of every show, my tagline is get outside, get into nature, and make your own discoveries. And right now, Dinosaur Train is reaching 15 million households a month. So it would be hard for me to have, you know, that big an impact through, for example, writing scientific papers. So I think that there's lots of ways to engage technology in this effort to help teachers, to help parents, and to help kids themselves.
You, of course, are the curator, the research curator at the Utah Museum of Natural History. What role do museums play in our culture, and how do we tap into that resource as parents and teachers?
Well, Salt Lake City is very fortunate. There is a brand new Utah Museum of Natural History, now going to be the Natural History Museum of Utah. There's a name change. And that's opening up in November 17th. And it will provide a great resource for Utah. And I think that natural history museums like this one are pivotal in making the transformation that I'm talking about, because they can provide local content. These museums interact with teachers. The teachers are sort of restricted by the curriculum that they're given, but they can go and learn things at the local museum, for example, about all the local natural history, plants and animals and rocks and stars, and how to engage kids in this material. So if we could start a national movement and then have these natural history museums provide the local content, that tag team could be very powerful in helping to bring about this transformation.
Mm. Scott Sampson, final question here. What's at stake? What if this disconnect between the natural world and our daily lives continues to grow? What do you see as the outcome?
It's funny to be asked questions like this, because you always sound like you're Chicken Little and yelling the sky is falling. It all depends on who you trust on this. I tend to go with the scientists who are talking about where we're heading right now, and that is, if we don't change what we're doing with global warming, the planet will warm up on the order of 3 degrees or more by the end of this century, causing major flooding around the world and desertification inland. If we don't stop the decimation of species, we could lose up to one half of all the diversity of species currently living on the planet by the end of this century. That's in the lifetime of children born today. Some people argue that human civilization is threatened, and I think that that's probably a pretty fair assessment. So will humans survive in some way? Probably. But do we really want to live in that kind of an impoverished way, and do we want to give that as a legacy to our children and grandchildren? Don't we want to respect them and all the other life forms on the planet and treat this place with more respect and make the changes that need to be made? So I think we're heading for a load of trouble. It's big change is coming one way or the other. Either we initiate it or Mother Nature is going to initiate it. And what I'm trying to do is do my part to help get humans thinking the right way and start this process rolling ourselves.
Dr. Scott Sampson. He's a paleontologist, evolutionary biologist, and research curator for the Utah Museum of Natural History. What's the new name? Museum of Natural History of Utah?
Correct.
Okay. Dr. Sampson will deliver the 61st annual Frederick W. Reynolds lecture at the University of Utah tomorrow night at 6:30. That's happening in the Varsity Room at Rice-Eccles Stadium. The lecture is free and open to the public for those 8 and older. For more information, you can call 801-585-0911 or just visit the City Views page on our website, kcpw.org. Dr. Sampson, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you very much, Jennifer. Have a great day.
You too. Up next, why Utah's forests are dying. But first, a quick break. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, and this is City Views. We now turn to the state of forests in the West. A special report in yesterday's Salt Lake Tribune details how beetles are ravaging forests throughout the region. Joining me now to discuss his investigation is Salt Lake Tribune reporter Brandon Loomis. And Brandon, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
If you'd like to join the conversation, if you have questions about the bug infestation of our forest, 801-355-TALK is our number, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Brandon Loomis, in your piece, you write that various bugs have swallowed 2 million acres of Utah forests, a patchwork about as large as Yellowstone National Park. Give us a sense of the scale of the problem and what's causing the rapid decline in western forests.
In Utah, that's mostly spruce beetles eating spruce in the mountains, and although there are other species as well, but that's just a small piece of what's happened in the West. It's 40 million acres around the West, not counting Canada. Mm. And, you know, we've had these large outbreaks in the past. A certain level of beetle kill is natural. But the thing I was surprised to find when I started working on this was sort of the depth of research that's gone on already about how much climate change has contributed to the problem. If you'd like me to explain, I guess, the components of that.
Yes, but first I want to find out what brought this whole story to your attention. What really put up the red flag for you and wanted you to encourage you to dig deep into this topic?
Just looking at the landscape. I mean, some of our editors had been out there. You know, we all spend time outdoors, and you see these forests turning gray. You know, the question just goes, what's happening? And then especially when you see that it's 3 or 4 times as big a problem in some other states neighboring us, we wanted to know what was happening. You know, we had heard for a long time, I think a lot of people are aware that there's debate about whether the government has appropriately managed the forests over the last century, particularly in the recent decades, whether there's enough management, enough activity, enough logging, for instance, or thinning. There's, I think, consensus more or less that fire suppression has had a role because we've allowed the forest to grow thicker than they might normally have been, and that stresses the trees and allows beetles to do more damage. And we had heard that there was climate component as well, but I tend to think of climate change as something sort of theoretical off in the future, and so I kind of thought when I started working on this that would be, you know, a question of whether climate change causes drought, for instance, you know, because we know we had a drought the last decade that obviously played a role in this. But it turns out that there are other drivers as well stemming from climate.
We'll get to the many causes of this, but I want to get an up close and personal look at the bugs, these yeah. little critters that are, you know, wreaking havoc in nature. What are these bugs? What are the beetles? Their lifespan, their reproductive rate, what their place is in the food chain? Are there predators for this beetle? Describe these little critters.
Yeah, there actually are predators. Woodpeckers, basically. You know, when you see woodpeckers hitting trees, that's what they're after. But I'm told that woodpeckers can't can't beat these things back because you know they might benefit when there are a lot of beetles, but they're when you have an outbreak like this, there are just so many that you can't possibly have enough birds to take care of them. The beetles themselves are very small. A lot of people describe them as being about the size of a grain of rice. And it depends on where you are, what the environment is in terms of temperature in winter for what their – or actually year-round for what their life cycle is. Some environments that are cold or up in the mountains, they can take 2 years to produce a new generation. In a lot of places, they take 1 year. But what they do is every July, they emerge from a tree, fly to a new tree, and bore through the bark and try to beat the tree's defenses, which basically is pitch or sap, which is toxic to them. But if one gets in there and finds that it's hospitable, maybe it's a tree that's under stress, they'll then send out a pheromone that attracts other trees because they have to have a mass attack to actually take down this tree and weaken its defenses.
Other insects.
Yeah. So depending on what kind of tree it is, it could be hundreds or it could be thousands of beetles that eventually end up in this tree. Once they've filled it to the point where they might overcrowd it have too many of them for their own good or for their young's good, they'll send out a pheromone that says no more.
So they're not feeding on the tree a parasite, but they're using it as a breeding ground?
It is a breeding ground, but once they're in there, they get into right under the bark is what they call the phloem. It's the layer that is the tree uses to conduct nutrients and water. And that's where they lay the eggs. And once the larvae, hatch, that's what they feed on is the phloem. So they do actually eat it and basically end up girdling the tree so that it can't conduct nutrients.
I'm speaking with Brandon Loomis, reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. If you have questions or comments about the decline of the western forest, And this is where the climate change discussion enters the picture, right? I mean, because the warming temperatures are more hospitable for these young little critters, they can reproduce at a faster rate. The deep freeze is not coming, and so
right.
They continue to live and thrive.
Yeah, I think there are two ways that temperature helped them. One is the deep freeze that you mentioned. There's just not as many cold spikes in our winters, which might knock them back a little bit more. And so more of them live on through the winter to emerge the next year, and then you get exponential growth. And the other way is just that from the warmth, they appear to increase their cycle so that in some of these colder places where it would have taken them 2 years before, now it takes them one to produce a new generation. Again, contributing to this exponential growth. There's debate about whether it happens in some of the warmer places, actually two generations in one summer. I heard scientists on both sides of that debate. It doesn't seem to be well documented that it's happening on a wide scale anyway.
Your investigative reporting took you quite far north. I'm curious about what is happening right here. In your report, you highlight what's happening at Brighton Ski Resort.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you can describe what is happening closer to home in terms of the forest and the beetles and the bug infestation.
Well, if you've been out in the forests of Utah over the last decade or so, you've noticed that these patches of gray trees are emerging, started down by cedar breaks, and it's come north, and there's a lot of it around Heber now. If you look at the map we published, there's a tremendous amount around the Uintas. But it's right over the crest of the Wasatch from our Cottonwood Canyons, and I think a lot of people go skiing up there and don't really have a sense that it's lurking there, but there are trees dying at the tops of those resorts from the beetles, and the resorts are doing a lot to try and stop it, either by putting up synthetic pheromones to try and ward off the beetles, or by cutting out trees that have died, and they're trying to plant new trees. But there's a lot of concern by the Forest Service that ultimately, if this, you know, if we don't have a number of cooler and wetter years, that those canyons could eventually be overwhelmed. And
what can be done to fight back nature? To we have this new environment that we have to deal with. What is being done, and what can be done to restore the forest, to stop the swarms of bugs that are destroying the forest? What is happening on the ground?
There are several things that the Forest Service and others are doing. Probably the simplest is just going out and cutting trees, live trees, where they are thick. If you know that beetles are moving through a certain area, you can go into an area, cut out trees, leaving, you know, in a lot of cases, they'll take out half, maybe, of the trees. And it opens it up. The beetles don't do as well in heat and, you know, in the summer, in direct sunlight. They can't overcome the trees' defenses as well when the trees are healthier and you know, are getting more moisture. So that's probably the primary way that you can take them on.
That takes a ton of manpower, though.
Yeah.
And chainsaws.
I mean, that's with any of these methods, the problem is that you don't have the people to do it. You don't have the money to do it. The government doesn't have money to do even a small fraction of what they'd like to do or what they feel could use the work. So they have to pick their battles and go to places like resorts, go to places like campgrounds, go to areas that they fear fire may get into subdivisions and actually be a hazard to people. But the other things that they can do are these what they call verbenone, the pheromone patches that you can put on these trees. You have to put them up every year. So, again, that's labor intensive.
On individual trees?
On individual trees,
wow.
Yeah. And you can also, there's, by the way, that only works with mountain pine beetles. They don't have such a pheromone for spruce beetles yet, so it doesn't take care of our problem in Utah. But they can also use a repellent called carbaryl. And the problem with that is that you have to soak the tree, the whole trunk of the thing with a hose. So it's not like you can do it from the air like a crop duster or something like that. And it's not even like you can get into, I mean, you have to have a truck with a tank, basically. So you have to have a road there. So, again, a lot of areas just aren't accessible for something like that.
Is the wood usable once a tree has been infected with these bugs? Could a logging company come in and make some good use of the wood, or is it not? Is it destroyed?
No, it's usable. And in fact, you know, some of the people who make log homes like it this way because the trees start to dry out already. The problem there is that it's still useful because they only penetrate the very outer part of it, you know. But the problem is that there's no one there. There's not really an industry in our area to use these trees. We used to have more when people were supplying timbers to the coal mines for their supports, but the coal mines started using something else, and most of our mills in this area have disappeared. So even when the Forest Service wants to sell some wood, or when they want to sell live trees, to thin areas, sometimes they'll get one bidder, sometimes they won't get any. So you could make use of it, but the question is who.
So what does all of this mean for our ecosystem, the big picture? I mean, as temperatures continue to rise, will this bug infestation will continue to proliferate beyond the West and the old growth forests? What is the projection?
Well, there's a lot of question about what happens next. I think some people will argue that eventually they sort of eat themselves out of house and home and things start over. Others are afraid that that everything has changed now and they'll just keep coming because it will keep getting warmer. What happens with the forests now? most of the people I've talked to tell me, you know, don't worry that there won't be a forest. You know, these areas will still grow trees. The question is, which trees will they grow? Maybe some of the species that grow lower on our hillsides will start to creep up the mountains, and maybe they will grow with more spacing because they won't have as much moisture. So we might have thinner forests than we're used to for the last century. But I think species composition is the big question, and that could change our ecosystems because some of the high elevation trees, limber pine in our up at the top of our canyons, and a similar tree called whitebark pine up in the Yellowstone area, these are trees that are really good at holding snowpack, you know, well into the summer, which has all kinds of implications both for our natural systems and our rivers, but also for us, for water that we use and for us having to treat water for cleanliness and storing water.
In one of the pieces you wrote, I believe it was an ecologist from the Tetons who was lamenting the destruction that I think it was a woman that she was seeing. And, you know, it seemed to be taking a real emotional toll to watch the deterioration of the forest. Can you talk about, you know, I understand you interviewed dozens and dozens of people. The people who have to watch this happen, how is it affecting their lives?
Yeah, I mean, especially up there in the Tetons, people move there for a reason, you know, for the nature. A lot of places in Utah as well, but up there, it's just incredible how much the whitebark pine has died off. If you get up in the air and look down on it, it's just mountain after mountain where they're just gray. And this is not just a question of trees up there or you know. Green, that's a tree that feeds wildlife, particularly grizzly bears, which everyone up there is concerned about. And so there are people who, whether it's because it's their job or just because they love the area, people who have taken it upon themselves to go out and hang these pheromone patches up there and recognize, you know, they will tell you that they know that they're not saving the world. They just hope that they can keep some tree. I mean, those trees live. The whitebark pine lives 1,000 years or more. So, if they can get it through this patch, maybe it hangs on. Maybe you have one little area that has seeds left to repopulate mountains and mountains. You know, that's it. It does get emotional for them. Some of them told me that individual trees that they've protected, when they go back the next year and see them dead, it's hard on them.
Mm. You spent months on this investigative series. You traveled over 3,000 miles. You climbed an 11,000-foot pass. I guess, what's the takeaway for you? What are the lessons that you learned about climate change and in our environment, and what policy implications does this have for our leaders, our political leaders?
Well, policy implications, I think there needs to be a debate about how important forest management is. The Forest Health Protection Division of the Forest Service takes care of things like, you know, they make grants to our states to deal with fire hazards around communities. They do wildlife enhancements, and they do this thinning that I'm talking about. They also have money to administer timber sales, which a lot of foresters think is important. But they only have $1 billion a year, which sounds like a lot of money, but there's 80 million acres in the West that they say need some kind of treatment. Mm. And that's, you're talking at a minimum tens of billions of dollars that it would take. So, I think it's important to consider what we want from our forests, you know, either economically or ecologically, and have a debate about what can be done about it, because everybody knows money's kind of tight right now. But if nothing is done, a lot of people fear that areas will lose their ecological components.
Mm. Brandon Loomis, he's a reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. He is the author of the series Our Dying Forests, a special report on the decline of forests in the Intermountain West. And Brandon Loomis, thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
City Views is a production of KCPW News with help from Eric Ray and Jesse Ellis. Ryan Cron composed our theme music. You can continue the discussion online at kcpw.org or check us out on Facebook and Twitter. Next time, a conversation with Mormon scholar Richard Bushman. That's coming up tomorrow. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.